Hello, SFIA audio listeners. In this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters, we'll take a look at what sorts of alien behemoths might be possible under known science. To hear it and every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur and use my code IsaacArthur. The galaxy is an immense and mysterious place we may one day explore and settle. But for now, we have only one planet, and the galaxy holds many dangers. So what can we do to defend Earth? One of the more fascinating things about the moon is all the craters on it, some of which are the size of continents. But when pondering those, it does raise the worrisome issue that Earth has probably been hit just as hard and often, and probably by rocks even bigger than the one we tend to say got the dinosaurs. Indeed, the moon's very existence is thought to be due to some small planet hitting proto-Earth and spewing out a debris cloud from which the moon formed. Needless to say, that is not a survivable strike. And indeed, if we detected anything like that coming our way right now, or an alien armada, or any of a number of other potential astronomic catastrophes, our best strategy would be to drop to our knees and pray. Should divine intercession not be forthcoming, it leaves you in an excellent position to kiss your butt goodbye. There's essentially no defense strategy available to us if we haven't got at least months to prepare right now, and against an alien armada or a full-scale planet careening our way, that wouldn't be enough time either, outside of a Hollywood movie. Indeed, there's not much you could do without centuries of advancement and forewarning in those two cases, which you might actually have, and we'll get to them later. But at the moment, even something a kilometer across would be something we need a large lead-up time to deploy against and deflect enough not to hit us. Thankfully, there are two important caveats here, even for those very large asteroids or alien invasion fleets. First, such catastrophic astronomical natural events are rare enough that the odds of one getting us this next century or so are pretty minimal, and lower the more severe the incident. We'll talk about the odds of asteroids by size and destructive capacity later, but for things well below the dinosaur killing scale, if we can detect it a couple days out, even now we could mitigate damage, in the sense of human casualties, by calculating the strike location and evacuating that area and bringing in personnel and resources to handle the aftermath. I doubt you could get everyone out of a major metropolis in that time, but you might be able to get most, and from smaller cities, probably nearly everyone. Plus, it is unlikely to impact on one. Second, we do have defensive strategies we can prepare with time and resources, and those work best on those more likely to occur, like a mile-wide asteroid heading our way, rather than something like an ejected black hole headed through our inner solar system. And even against such an overwhelming threat, we do have options, even if we might need some centuries to be developed enough in space to manage them. We also do know where most one-mile-wide asteroids near Earth are, and none are plausible to hit next century, so that mostly limits it to deep space or interstellar asteroids. We are going to look through a number of threats today in increasing order of concern, and dwelling on those earlier and milder threats like asteroids, rogue spacecraft, orbital bombardments, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections. But we'll move on to look at extreme scenarios including supernovae and gamma-ray burst defense, the asteroid being an entire planet instead, an ejected black hole passing nearby, a von Neumann swarm of alien or earthly origin, or perhaps launched from an interstellar colony of ours that lost control of an experiment, or deployed relativistic kill missiles our way, or even a Nicol Dyson beam, before contemplating what we do if an alien armada really does show up. The key defense against the milder scenarios, though, is the successful development of cislunar space, so you can get resources and equipment in play, and so that you have a detection system that can give you the earliest warning. This is why defending Earth is one of the four pillars of the National Space Society, along with last week's topic of clean energy from space. And those two, along with developing space and communities in space, were up on one of our audience image polls back in November and won. You voted for them, and now we're giving them each their own episode. You're probably not creating vast power or detection grids or defenses to protect Earth without developing space and creating those communities up in orbit and connected to support from down here on the ground, which is why they are so important to the NSS. And for folks new to the show, wondering who this guy with the weird voice is, I am Isaac Arthur, host of this show, Science and Futurism, for almost 10 years now, and president of the National Space Society for just over a year now. I am a theoretical physicist by training and a veteran of the U.S. Army, and I have also had the honor of guest lecturing at the U.S. Air Force Academy and consulting for the Space Force back when it was just starting. You have to rattle off the qualifications occasionally so folks assume there's a chance you know what you're talking about rather than spouting crazy nonsense. Though as some folks often note, sanity is an optional trait for scientists and futurists anyway. And like a lot of you probably also have, I've spent a lot of time reading and watching science fiction and pondering the threats presented in those and saying, well, if they'd just done X instead, or hey, that's not how physics works. I've consulted on a lot of science fiction over the years, usually where the author or game developer wants to see if something is very realistic, and while I always encourage that, it comes attached with the advice that you should never let reality get in the way of a good story. I'm very fortunate to have a lot of friends and colleagues who've also spent a lot of time seriously thinking and writing on these topics that I can draw from. Also, I tend to take the reverse approach of what I recommend to sci-fi authors by trying to figure out how to deal with over-the-top projects and threats. I figure out what we want to do and then see if reality permits it, even if only by extreme measures that might seem unbelievable to us now. Otherwise, you can get lost in conventional wisdom and stuff everybody knows, or everybody knows is not possible. And that's a good place to segue into asteroids, because every so often I'll hear someone saying you wouldn't want to blow one up with a big nuke or that wouldn't work. And the answer is implied by one of our show's favorite mottos, if brute force isn't working, you just aren't using enough of it. Which was also the unofficial motto of my old artillery regiment. Nukes are a great solution to a lot of problems, in accordance with the first rule of warfare, that there is no such thing as overkill. But they often are not going to be your easiest or best approach. You can't just launch an ICBM up into space. They don't carry enough fuel to get into orbit, let alone away from Earth. Nor can we just slap an ICBM into a big rocket, get into orbit, then launch it from there at an asteroid. Now, the Department of Energy is responsible for our nuclear stockpile, and I'm glad to say they take planetary defense quite seriously, but our detection window is still small, and our ability to respond is very limited. We need a lot more development up there to pull off the delivery of a nuke to a large asteroid far enough away to matter, and that same development does offer some other solutions. On the plus side, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory did some modeling on nukes against asteroids recently, and was pretty optimistic about their potential too. I want to talk about some of the other approaches we'll use on an asteroid, but I also want to ask what sort of infrastructure, capabilities, and development we need to pull these off. Last week we spent a lot of time talking about power satellites and beaming technology, for instance, to provide Earth with clean energy, and such platforms offer us a couple ways to engage asteroids too. Now, asteroids are going to be unlike many of our other threats in that they tend to be pretty visible and give you a lot of reaction time, compared to our relativistic kill missile, for instance, which might be moving 10,000 times as fast and perhaps 100 millionth the size of an asteroid carrying the same damage potential, meaning it needs to be 10,000 times closer before you see it with the same detector, and since it's moving 10,000 times faster, will give you 100 millionth of the reaction time. Asteroids also won't generally be moving in a straight line toward us. They'll be on some elliptical orbital path of their own that happens to intercept us, and we may get decades of advance notice by spotting and calculating that a few more of its orbital cycles it's going to cross our path too closely. It is generally not hurtling in from deep space, and if it were, it would probably have a nice ice shell that began giving a comet tail we could spot more easily. Instead, your default asteroid is from the various near-Earth objects or asteroids, of which there's many thousands. And after that, one of the many millions hanging out in the asteroid belt, or the various loose families of asteroids elsewhere in the system. Lots of those are broken remnants of bigger asteroids that collided with something in the past, and often some collision like that is what pushes them into an orbit that's going to eventually hit a planet, since otherwise their mass has been orbiting the sun just fine for billions of years and hundreds of millions of orbital cycles. Of these, the specific characteristics of the asteroid matter, as a metallic one is different than one more composed of silicon or carbon, or ices for that matter. But I would say anything over 10 meters across has a non-zero chance of damaging something here on Earth, very non-zero if it's made out of nickel or iron and is bigger. And even things as small as a millimeter across can damage some spacecraft, station, or satellite in space. So your detection goal is to begin by detecting anything threatening Earth, and the bigger the threat, the bigger the asteroid, and easier it is to spot. And gradually you get better at spotting and managing them, till you're able to detect even against small ones that threaten only your orbital infrastructure, not your planet. By examining craters here and on the moon, where they are easier to see, as well as the composition of the asteroid belt, we know about how often bigger ones come, statistically anyway, and frequency is essentially inverse with mass, or inverse with the cube of diameter, as mass rises with the cube of diameter. So 10 times the diameter, 1,000 times the mass and destructive potential, and we would expect them to show up about a thousandth as often. We estimate an asteroid 1 kilometer across tends to hit Earth a couple times per million year period. Such an asteroid carries more kinetic energy in it than all the nuclear weapons we've ever built combined, but is arguably a smaller threat than them, since we can target those strategically to hit cities, while an asteroid or volcano, which is in a similar energy scale, are statistically unlikely to come down on any city, let alone break up to hit each one of them. As such, it could certainly wreak havoc on civilization, but not in a civilization-ending way. And it is something that has occurred repeatedly while humans have existed, depending on where we want to place the cutoff in either what qualifies a human or how big the asteroid needs to be to qualify. But I should note that even one just 10 meters across is typically carrying as much energy as our earliest nuclear bombs, and we typically get one of these once a decade. These are going to airburst, which makes them leave multiple small craters, if any, as opposed to a big one, and that further reduces their threat as the atmosphere is soaking up most of their energy. We would generally expect anything much under 40 meters across not to leave a single crater, even one made of iron. This is one reason breaking an asteroid into pieces right before it hits us can be a good thing, though it can also result in a shotgun blast-style effect, and one very likely to set off a Kessler syndrome event in orbit, damaging or even ruining our orbital infrastructure in the process, which is why it's better to get them sooner. Right now, if we had maybe a month's warning, we could potentially get some nukes up into higher orbits and on an orbital path that would take them near the asteroid as it came by to be hit by some of that nuclear explosion. Maybe even a close proximity strike would break it apart. Whether or not you want to break an asteroid apart, especially that close, is very debatable. So is where you should detonate a nuke for maximum effect, though I think the strongest argument is for a short distance from it to spread the blast over its surface, similar to when we contemplate using a nuke on the pusher plate of an Orion Drive spacecraft. Where, how, and when are tricky topics, though. More modeling experience is needed. And it depends on a lot of factors specific to the asteroid and intercept scenario. We discussed the specifics more in our asteroid defense episode some years back, but ultimately, the bigger our warning time, the better we can handle the problem. The capacity to ensure a warning like that has slowly been growing and is nearly upon us, and largely because of AI, which can scan a big cluster of data, such as telescope and radar data, for something tiny like the sunlight or radar scatter off a rock 100 million miles away, pick it up a handful of times in a short interval, and automatically calculate its trajectory to see if it's in a threatening window. Then forward those on to people at a big telescope they can aim at it, or a big gun for that matter. And that helps, but honestly, such a rock still has a high probability of landing somewhere virtually uninhabited, and 70% chance of hitting the ocean, and just doesn't carry enough energy to cause a sweeping tsunami along a coastline. Over a certain mass range, it's going to hurt pretty much no matter where it lands, but most asteroids are smaller. In sci-fi, we always encounter one big enough to wreck a city or big enough to wreck a continent, and the former are a million times more frequent and have way less than 1% chance of landing near a city, let alone a major metropolis. If you actually knew where the rock was going to land and it wasn't catastrophically big, then in most cases you would rather let it come in than have its blasted remains whacking through your orbital infrastructure. Unless it's hitting something heavily populated, you just evacuate all your people, pets, and precious objects from the blast radius and rebuild afterward. But the smaller that asteroid, the harder it's going to be to see it and get a precise vector a long time out, and the more likely it is to have fragmentation during atmospheric entry significantly alter its course. Does that mean we should ignore this threat? No. though on the scale of thousands of years, it's really more of a threat to our developed orbital space rather than a reason to develop that orbital space to protect Earth from asteroids. Also a nice economic boon, too, because an asteroid is valuable raw materials entering Earth orbital space rather than one we have to mine from 100 million miles away. So your real aim is to capture it into a nice stable orbit and without too much fragmentation. Aside from nukes, there are a few other mature ideas on deflecting asteroids. You can impact it with something, which we tried with the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART, a couple years back. And this might be a series of collisions with multiple spacecraft or projectiles. There was also the idea you could paint the object, either dark or light, so that it reflected or absorbed sunlight, which might push it off course as it absorbs that momentum. But the method I tend to prefer is just to focus an energy beam on the rock or ice ball to ablate or vaporize some material off the rock as a rocket stream that pushes it off course. And that will do, but I'd imagine the more long term you would expect a spacecraft to go to one, place a microwave receiver and engine on it, and let an incoming energy beam power a more controlled thrust that efficiently and predictably brings the rock into a new orbit of your choosing with little loss of fragmentation. That's the sort of exercise a good asteroid mining company will probably excel at, and which I would expect us to have a modestly robust supply of within a century or two, thus I don't really worry much about asteroids as a threat to Earth. Fist-sized rocks in orbit, which are very common, are more of a concern, and only grow more so as we develop more things in space, especially large cross-section satellites like solar power satellites. See our recent episode on clearing space debris for more discussion of managing those, though. As mentioned, another option is to ram one with a high-speed and high-mass spacecraft, though that's likely to produce a lot of debris, as we discovered with DART about 2 years back. Also, that high-speed ramming craft option actually represents a bigger threat to us than those asteroids, and requires a better detection system. A rogue spaceship moving at interplanetary speeds isn't all that high energy compared to an asteroid of the same size. It might be moving faster and carrying an order of magnitude more kinetic energy per kilogram, but is also mostly hollow. As such, it is easier to detect, pound for pound, so to speak. Unfortunately, it can also be aiming itself rather precisely, letting it hit any given space station or space habitat, and it might have atmospheric re-entry protection so as to allow it to come through intact to hit a major metropolis right in downtown. It can also unpredictably change course. So it might only have the energy of a rock 10 meters across, but that's still a small nuclear bomb, and one presumably any person with access to a shuttle-sized spacecraft could hijack. This means you need monitoring and active defense measures in place for handling such scenarios, and that conveniently handles your smaller and more frequent asteroids too, as they're easier to spot, slower, and easier to target with longer to work with. A bit like aircraft, scale is the biggest factor in damage, so you can escalate your security measures with scale in mind. This is also where regulation matters earlier on, as until we have enough assets in space to make such monitoring both necessary and possible, we can mostly relax in the confidence of knowing that current spacecraft would need the assistance of flight control to calculate such a suicide run so as to hit their desired target. When you are moving several kilometers per second, you can't really be placing yourself in wherever you please using your Mark 1 eyeball. But as computers and AI get better and more compact, and spacecraft more common, one loony with some skill, or a terrorist cell with some coordination might be able to pull this off. Or they might be a spacecraft owned by some rogue state that's going to have an accident. The good news is that for detection purposes, we don't need more advanced science here, we just need more telescopes and detectors aimed at space or up in space, and better AI and algorithms for helping on it. And this will come organically in our continuing development of both astronomical and defense assets. At some point, we'll probably need a formal grid up there. Things like the space fence system, but scaled up. And that is going to be a non-trivial defense budget item, and is more ideal for something like the emerging Space Force as opposed to NASA and its cousin agencies around the world. I would also tend to assume the US wouldn't be the only folks working on that, but while we might see NATO or allied nations developing one used together, I would not expect global participation on that. And exactly because the bigger threat is man-made objects, which a rogue agency might deploy. Of course, a nation-state might be the secret backers of such a rogue agency, but they also might consider full-scale orbital bombardment this way rather than some singular strike. And in a case like this, the full escalation scenario probably involves seeking to cripple the detection grid and orbital defense grid first. This escalation is likely to come with some advanced warning. Generally speaking, wars rarely start without advanced warning. When they do, they tend to either start small or start barely coordinated, or both. There's a lot of logistics involved in a major operation like that, and trying to keep any whiff of it from getting out in advance tends to be nigh impossible, and comes with trade-offs between a decent chance of secrecy at the cost of lots of unprepared or underprepared errors. Need-to-know operations tend not to scale well, and start forgetting to include important folks in the planning. You show up for the invasion and half your troops are missing or half asleep, and logistics wasn't told to move spare fuel into the area. You also not likely have all your orbital detection and defense systems in orbit themselves, with a lot inside nicely shielded groundside bunkers, and anybody who starts enthusiastically blowing orbital infrastructure up is doing so with the full knowledge that this is an open declaration of war on everybody else with assets up there, since all that space debris is likely to damage things indiscriminately. See our orbital bombardment episode for more on the types of weapons those can entail, both near-term and higher-tech, as well as the ground-side defense strategies you can employ, which can also entail mobile and stealthy submarines as opposed to bunkers in the actual ground. Generally speaking, space itself does not allow a lot of options for stealth, beyond the sheer speed and enormity of things making it hard to spot and react to things in time, especially as that speed lets them be relatively small objects for their damage potential. Some things also move a lot faster than even spacecraft and asteroids. Solar flares and coronal mass ejections thankfully take some time to develop where we can spot them, and they are pretty visible, but they move fast. Solar wind in general moves a couple orders of magnitude faster than orbital spacecraft, and while it isn't subtle, you can't defend against that by blowing up the individual particles, since in this case, they are indeed individual particles at the atomic scale, not millimeters to kilometers across. This is another example of where prediction and early detection are vital, but here we have options like placing a big solar deflector at our L1 Lagrange point, much as we discuss using to help protect a possible future Martian atmosphere in our episode on giving Mars a magnetosphere. We discuss these more in our January episodes on statites and lagites and Lagrange point settlement, but short form, while Earth's magnetosphere is huge and powerful, deflection in space is just as easy to achieve with an early and small push as a late and powerful one, much like with asteroids. Our L1 Lagrange point is 4 times further from us than our moon is, and always between us and the sun, and is 200 times further from Earth's center than Earth's own surface is, let alone that big spinning ball of molten metal in our core. As such, it needs only give a fractionally smaller magnetic nudge to incoming ionized particles as they approach from the sun to scatter them away from our planet and its vulnerable infrastructure on Earth and in orbit. Indeed, with ligites, we can put it even closer, and the sort of huge power collector running a massive electromagnet is exactly the sort of device that works well as a statite or ligite, or perhaps a swarm of such devices at a smaller scale, but operating in tandem. Nor are we contemplating massive objects for this purpose, merely large but thin solar collectors running fairly simple electromagnets and at power levels we already generate here on Earth. This, incidentally, would also work against something like a shockwave coming in off the galactic core, though would need to be lined up in that direction, and keeping things between us and other stars is a bit trickier than with our own sun. Speaking of giant explosions and other stars, while the danger of supernovae and gamma ray bursts to Earth tends to be somewhat exaggerated, it is a possibility. A key point today is that we are most threatened by other intelligences rather than natural catastrophes. We can hardly ignore the latter as they're quite real, but we principally need to prepare ourselves against man-made, or AI or alien-made attacks, not just natural disasters. However, the devices built to protect against intelligent actors will often work for natural disasters too, and often more easily. A supernova scatters an intense blast of radiation and high-energy particles in a wide omnidirectional blast, and thus loses potency with the distance. And while they are insanely powerful, they generally would leave planets behind, even in their own solar system, especially gas giants. Nobody living on their surface or in orbit of them is surviving, of course, even stuff living in ultra-deep underwater trenches, which would be boiling their way off into space with a blast. But planetary distance is on an order of 10 to 100,000 times smaller than the distance to the neighboring solar system, and because it falls off inverse square, those energies are falling off on an order of hundreds of millions to billions of times weaker. Such explosions are visible at the moment they strike, but moving at or near light speed, so there's not much immediate warning. But there's no supernova candidates close enough to Earth to cause any serious damage to us at the moment, and such stars are always going to be easily naked eye visible to us if they're in range, so they don't sneak up on you. Here you could employ a large thin metal shield that was literally hanging between us and that star, and was paper thin, and which you would need to use some fairly coordinated energy beaming and station keeping to remain at that spot or moving window, probably way out in a trans-Neptunian orbit or even further. We can't determine exactly when a supernova is going to occur down to a precise moment yet, but our observations of supernovae are mostly after the fact, so we don't know if there's very obvious pre-detonation signs. At a minimum, you should get a few hours advance notice if you have decent neutrino detectors, and then you could have some big guns packed with shells full of folded up shielding that could fire them in that direction, and which could then pop off and expand to form a cloud of shielding the supernova particle wave would run into. Indeed, you might use a whole ton of big inflatables full of gas to help absorb the energy and re-emit it in less harmful frequencies. It is an awful lot of energy. Even a few dozen light years off, a Type 1A supernova might whack Earth with as much radiation as the sun gives us over many hours, and not in benign wavelengths. But if some shield or cloud absorbs the energy coming toward Earth and is vaporized by it, that gas is emitting what it absorbs omnidirectionally now, and in low energy photons. Based on the star or stellar remnant in question, you will know how much its blast will produce, and can prepare to put the right amount of matter to absorb the blast in between you and it. But you could easily have several million joules impact per square meter, so this is not a case where your shield is tissue paper thick, the way our statites we discuss normally are, but you do not need a planet-sized slab of metal meters thick either. For a Type 2 supernova anyway, that's a big star exploding, and you will be expecting that event and build such detectors and defenses if you have such a star in threat range or migrating into range or age. Centuries of advance notice are implied there at a minimum. Type 1A supernovae, which is when a white dwarf absorbs enough matter to detonate, do not give that specific core collapse warning that big stars when fusing and imploding on their iron core do. However, that amount of mass is fairly precise, the Chandrasekhar limit of 1.4 solar masses, and we are likely to get even more accurate with that. And also unlikely to miss any white dwarf in that mass range with our modern capabilities, especially it is likely to have a binary partner donating mass. Same basic defense applies. Gamma ray bursts are less well understood at this time, and also directional, so they can be dangerous from thousands of light years away, not dozens. And this is exactly where more knowledge and better observations are vital and the cornerstone of defense. Knowing is half the battle, or maybe more, and the same sort of defense work. When it comes to truly large objects like rogue planets, that knowledge is even more important because unlike stars, or even dead stars like white dwarfs, they do not emit much radiation of their own for us to detect. Neither do asteroids, but distance is a big deal here. The amount of sunlight bouncing off an object is inverse square to its distance. The amount of light we need to see an object by follows this same ratio. So an object 10 times further from us than the sun is giving off 1/100 of light, and only 1/100 of that light reaches us, so it's 10,000 times harder to see. This is why Mercury and Mars are visible to our eyes, but Pluto requires a decent telescope to spot. A rogue planet entering our solar system that's just a 1/6 of a light year away, just a few percent of the distance to the nearest star, is 10,000 AU, astronomical units, or 10,000 times further from the sun than Earth is, and thus get 10 millionth of the sunlight to reflect off itself, and a 10 millionth of that is what reaches us, so it's not even a trillionth as bright as Mars. Thankfully, it will be emitting light of its own, from its own internal heat. And that won't be much and will be in the infrared, but will be significantly more and is in the spectrum we are looking for with infrared exoplanet or rogue interstellar planet hunts. If we detected it 10,000 AU away, even if it was moving at 100 km per second relative to us, we would have about 500 years advance warning. Now, the problem is what you can do with that much warning, since it doesn't have to hit us to seriously screw up the solar system. Indeed, if it passes between Earth and the Sun in that volume, the damage could be in the form of Earth being heavily and fatally perturbed from its orbit. The odds of direct impact are slim, but utterly ruinous. Can you defend against that? Yes. Yes, we could potentially send a mission there, and with the intent of blowing it off course or into a stable orbit in the outer solar system where it would pose no threat other than possibly perturbing some comets and asteroids to migrate in-system, which is a much more manageable situation. See our episode Planet Ships for a full discussion of how to either move a planet so it doesn't hit us, or to make Earth able to survive such an ejection into deep space itself, or even move Earth out of the course of direct collision. As always, time is your ally. The longer you have to act, the smaller a push the incoming rock needs to be deflected, and the more time you have to assemble a stronger push. This can even work on an ejected black hole more massive than our own sun, which might be making its way out of the galaxy and at a few hundred kilometers per second. Thankfully, black holes are not terribly hard to see in spite of their reputation, especially one winging through the void, perturbing other stars and gathering interstellar gas into its accretion disk. We probably would not see one well right now, but even within a century or two, we should be able to comfortably spot one several centuries before arrival. This was the catastrophe premise in the prologue of our episode Colonizing Alpha Centauri, and is to this day the only natural catastrophe I'd say represents a true threat to humanity's existence beyond the next century or so, and even then only for a few centuries, as it would endanger not just Earth but all our other planets and asteroid habitats and so on. In that episode, we pointed out that the main risk would be it passing by and causing perturbation to eject Earth to put us in a bad orbit. Though it is worth noting that planetary orbits are not as stable and eternal as we tend to think, and we could get ejected from our solar system without any external astronomical disruption coming in from deep space. Of course, a black hole has far more mass to cause such a disruption, and it could end up devouring our sun explosively too, though more likely would pass through in a dangerously perturbative way to orbits and possibly devour something smaller in a vicious blast of gamma radiation. Now, humanity would be in a good position to survive this if we already had a decent supply of space habitats and asteroid colonies, and getting yourself into the orbital wake of such a behemoth leaves you in a powerful position, as we discussed in other black hole episodes. A stellar mass black hole is a rare and valuable object we are likely to actively seek out and colonize around, but trying to save Earth from a close passage of one is definitely an uphill fight, and the sort best done by a Kardashev 2 scale or interstellar civilization with some practice at stellar engineering and the resources implied, as you will need to be throwing the mass of whole planets at such an object to move it off course, and it will be moving that mass out as ultra-high energy radiation as you do this, which is exactly what makes them so valuable if you can do this in a controlled and long-term fashion, as opposed to trying to star lift your sun to provide a matter beam to hit it with, or chucking planets at it, or trying to build a megastructure around it to create one of the stellar engines we discussed in Fleet of Stars to make it a big spaceship under your control. This is exactly the sort of tasks self-replicating machines like von Neumann probes presumably excel at, along with making paperclips. But we have to worry about them going crazy or encountering some alien hegemonizing swarm. These don't have to be dumb, but it's usually assumed they are fairly locust-like and stupid, as you don't give such things a ton of brains unless you are feeling especially reckless and suicidal as a species. As such, they represent a sort of in-between case straddling natural catastrophes and intelligent enemies. They are the locust swarm or sledgehammer hurricane that comes to your planet intent on turning it into more of themselves, or automated kilimajigs or paperclips or whatever they want or space doing. We tend to assume their exploratory probes or automated terraforming machines run amok, and might be our own coming back to say hello from an early space settlement effort, which at least means you have some forewarning and an instruction manual. See your favorite sci-fi show for handling the variations of these, but I would rate them as considerably more likely to trouble us in a serious way than any of the natural disasters we discussed to this point. Your biggest ally here is that you do have brains, and you can't even consider defenses like releasing other self-replicating machines that specialize in killing these other ones or hijacking them, like immune systems or viruses do. As I've mentioned on other occasions, while I don't expect to find any intelligent aliens in this galaxy, or their leftover toys or mistakes, if there had been other intelligent civilizations out there that made it to space, I would have to expect the reason for their absence and all continued existence to be because a lot of these sorts of devices and counteragents had gotten deployed and left whole ecosystems of dumb machines and gray goo infesting regions of the galaxy. See our Aliens vs. AI episode and its discussion of the aliens known as the Recluse and their crazy sector of space for more contemplation of that. But in the end, brains beat muscle, especially when those brains can make machines that can make more of themselves to give you more muscle at your disposal, because brains are even better when armed with a giant space gun. Once you start putting brains and malice into play, things get worse, of course, and we have to consider not just aliens but intelligent AI, and options like angry interstellar space settlements of renegades or mutants deciding they want to wipe us out. This is where RKMs, relativistic kill missiles, and Nyko Dyson beams come into play, and the former are small and discrete hunks of metal with a little bit of detection and guidance on them, moving at near light speed, while the latter is basically a star converted into a giant laser. See our Orbital Defense Platforms episode for the full discussion of how to protect against these sorts of attacks, along with fleets and armadas, but tends to be like a lot of warfare. If your enemy is building it, you do too, and use smaller forms for protection and threats of mutually assured destruction. Diplomacy is generally in play once other intelligence is involved too, albeit it might be very limited and confined to nothing but threats of mutual mortar. But if someone is throwing dumb matter at you at super high speeds, you defend by being ready to detect that far out and throw something dumb in its path to destroy both. And you build response systems the enemy knows exist, so they know that if they attack your homeworld with some doomsday device you've got on alert in deep space or another star system will launch on them. And you make sure you've got lots of scattered colonies who can survive you or accept refugees or get you some vengeance. Of course, they may be the ones attacking you too, and that brings us to our final threats for discussion today, a giant alien armada, because this is both more and less survivable than it might at first seem. As we discussed in our Alien Civilization series, there's not much motive to conquer Earth unless you subscribe to the idea that all the resources in the universe must be yours or that all the intelligence must be wiped out, in which case it's very statistically unlikely that in the galaxy billions of years older than our own planet, such a species would just happen to have never evolved until maybe the last million or so years and just now be reaching us. They do not and never needed any signal from us to alert them we existed, because Earth is very visible, and the galaxy is not a dark forest to them, because they either chopped it all down for lumber, or they set the whole thing on fire to help them see and kill their prey. That means that odds are if they are aliens nearby us who could send armadas, they are numerous in kind and type, with many of them not being motivated to consume all or exterminate all. Thus, anyone trying to do that doesn't just have us to worry about, which would be no worry at all right now. They would trash us completely if they showed up tomorrow. But all those other neighbors, be they other aliens or disparate colonies, and their own internal factions and feuds too, act as a check on them. Again, see our Alien Civilization and Fermi Paradox series for more discussion of those sorts of scenarios. Earth might get destroyed for some seemingly weird reasons by aliens, like uploading our minds to a virtual subverse, or sending the Vogons in to demolish Earth to make way for a hyperspace bypass. At the moment at least, they seem to either not exist anywhere near us, or not be interested in conquering, absorbing, or obliterating us. Ultimately, I would not want us to rely on that good fortune of having friendly and non-expansionist neighbors. The best way to defend Earth is to develop space and the technology to help us detect threats earlier and prepare robust measures. And the best way to defend humanity is to explore and develop space and make sure not all of humanity is located on this one beautiful, precious, but terribly vulnerable, pale blue dot. Odds are, if you're watching this show, you're a big fan of science, and probably like me, enjoy sci-fi too. be it books, TV, video games, or good old tabletop RPGs. I've been rolling dice, making characters, running games, and building settings for almost 30 years now, and as you'd probably guess, I tend to be noted for the depth of world building I tend to do. And if you're running a tabletop, or writing a novel, or designing a game, the audience always appreciates those extra touches that help with immersion and adding depth to the setting. That's where a world anvil can be an amazing tool for organizing your campaigns or stories, and also for helping craft content and share it. World Anvil, the award-winning world-building toolset, is an amazing suite of software for gaming and world-building that lets you use all the awesome modern computerized options while still enjoying the versatility of pencil and paper gaming, or fantasy and sci-fi novel writing for that matter. Create customized articles and entries, interactive maps, wiki-style presentations, character chronicles, event timelines, genealogies of characters, and many other awesome features to help you craft your world. World Anvil is also amazing for helping you run your game with a digital GM screen and campaign manager with support for over 45 tabletop RPG systems, including a robust library of character sheets and stat blocks, not to mention wonderful tutorial videos exploring features to make it easy for you and your players to use, and giving great world building and story crafting ideas to help you on your hero's journey. World Anvil has all the tools you need. To try it out, just click the link in the episode's description and start forging new worlds today. So as I mentioned, this episode is one of the foundational topics of the National Space Society, as is last week's episode on clean energy from space, and I want to thank John Daigle, Dale Scran, and Rod Pyle from the NSS for lending their expertise to writing these episodes. Every year we host the International Space Development Conference, where experts in the field, be they from NASA to commercial space leaders like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, have given talks, and where you can meet with astronauts and best-selling sci-fi authors. This year's conference is in Los Angeles at the Sheraton Gateway, May 23rd to 26th, and will be hosted by Melissa Navia, Helmsman Ortegas from Star Trek's Strange New Worlds. We also give out awards, and two folks coming by to receive them this year will be my good friend Brian McManus from the amazing show Real Engineering, and the legendary William Shatner. Come join us as we boldly explore strange new worlds. Speaking of sci-fi, this weekend it'll be time again for Sci-Fi Sunday here on SFIA, where we'll be looking at the idea of stargates and parallel devices for bridging between worlds, and ask if there's any theories bridging between science and sci-fi there. Then we'll take a look at a different type of tunnel, the immense lava tubes on the moon, and what life in those might be like for lunar settlers. Then we'll finish out the month with a pair of episodes looking at colonizing white dwarf star systems, bringing new life to those dead stars, and binary star systems and their unique challenges with habitable zones and stability. If you'd like to get alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to hit the like, subscribe, and notification buttons. You can also help support the show on Patreon. And if you'd like to donate or help in other ways, you can see those options by visiting our website, isaacarthur.net. You can also catch all of SFIA's episodes early and ad-free on our streaming service, Nebula, along with hours of bonus content, like Galactic Beacons, at go.nebula.tv/isaacarthur. Thanks for watching, and have a great week.